You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Hey, brand builders. Before we start this week's show, just a reminder that this podcast is brought to you by the industry-leading Social Brand Forum. This premier digital marketing experience takes place on October 15th through the 16th at the historic Engler Theater in beautiful downtown Iowa City, Iowa. We bring the best marketing thought leaders like Mitch Joel, Mark Schaefer, and Amber Naslund to the heart of the heartland for a two-day event to help you take your brand's digital marketing from good to great. Podcast listeners get the best rate by using promo code ONBRAND. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com. Can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Amber Naslund. Amber is the SVP, that's Senior Vice President of Marketing for Sysomos, a global leader in social intelligence. She's a dynamic communication strategist with deep experience and with a personal passion for the emergence of social business. Her professional expertise spans nonprofit management, corporate communications, marketing, professional services, and social business strategy. She's successfully run multi-million-dollar fundraising campaigns, built and led executive communications and professional services teams, and launched and grown international brands. As an entrepreneur and executive, she has advised Fortune 500 companies like L'Oreal, American Express, AMD, Dell, Avaya, CDW, Kraft Foods, and Coca-Cola, as well as their executives on social business strategy and new workforce culture. Amber is also the co-author of the best-selling social business book, The Now Revolution. She delivers dozens of keynote speeches on corporate culture, social business, and communication at industry conferences and private events every year, such as the Social Brand Forum, coming up in just a few weeks back here in Iowa. Amber, welcome to the On Brand Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick. I see you have the long form of my bio.
I do. You know, as many things as we can list, you did not, I think it's Scott Stratton that has listed, the short bio, the long bio, and then like the ridiculously long one. So
yeah, I think you probably have my ridiculously long version, but that's cool. Like now everybody knows just about everything.
They know all of the things. Is there anything that is not in that ridiculously long bio, which, by the way, as someone that reads bios here on the On Brand Podcast every week, that's not ridiculously long.
Oh, okay, well, that's good to know. I think it's kind of a thing with marketers. We hate writing our own bios.
I actually, from a past guest, Tamsin Webster, she had a Facebook post recently about some sort of creating some sort of guide to bio writing. And I would, as someone that reads bios and also writes my own, I would love any insight on bio writing.
Yeah, it's not a fun task, and I don't particularly think I'm very good at it, but there you go.
Well, it's interesting because I'm sure that, we could shoehorn this into the context of branding because, you want to brand and position yourself, but it's like, what's the fine line between, when you cross the line and you're like, oh, and it's horrible when you have to listen to it. I spoke at an event yesterday and I was listening to my bio being read and I was a little, And it's like, what face do you make if you have to be on stage while the bio's read or just off stage or nearby when your bio's being read? It's like, it's tricky territory.
I just sort of smile and nod, smile and nod.
That's smile me.
Yeah, that's me over there. Yeah,
that's
I don't know.
That's what I do.
I, I think cute bios can be fun and whatever, but I typically look at it as if I'm speaking at an event, my bio is the tool that the audience gets to learn whether or not I'm even qualified to be on that stage. So I try not to be too cutesy with it, but
yeah, well, and, I know this is a surprise, but I'm not a household name.
You are in my household name. We talk about you all the time here.
But in most, I'm not. So you do, like you said, you have to use it to credential yourself a little bit. But it's interesting because as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, some of the best bios, but again, not everybody can get away with it because they don't need as much credentialing. But I think of, you know, if you go by what, you know, someone like Guy Kawasaki provides, it's pretty short because it can be. And wouldn't that be something awesome to aim for, where you can just...
Yeah, there was a discussion on Facebook the other day about this, and somebody said, you know, when you introduce Warren Buffett, all you need to say is, ladies and gentlemen, Warren Buffett. But some of the rest of us need a little...
Yeah, exactly. We're not there yet. We're not in the Buffett sphere yet.
No. I aspire to the Buffett sphere, though, both financially and otherwise.
Well, you know, he's at least somewhat in our ecosystem. We can claim to being fellow Midwesterners. So that's albeit on the other side of that as well. But
cool. Well, we'll roll with that then.
So Amber, what wasn't in the bio, or is there anything that wasn't in the bio?
Work wise or personally? Because I mean, there's tons of the personal stuff that's not in there, but. You know, it's mostly the stuff that people are always surprised to find out about me, like that I was a music major in college. I didn't major in marketing. I ended up in this field kind of accidentally. That I rescue pit bulls in my spare time, that I'm an avid horseback rider. So I don't know. Like sometimes people find those personal interest parts interesting and sometimes they don't.
I do, because, you know, in addition to the fellow Midwesterner points, the music major is something that I always find fascinating and relevant, partially because of my own background as a theater major. And sometimes I feel myself apologizing for it, but I'm trying to do that less, because I always think it's interesting when someone has a non-marketing B-school path. So, I mean, how do you find that? Do you find that?
I've been really surprised, first of all, for how many people in marketing, communications, like kind of this side of the world, that have some kind of fine arts background, whether it's visual arts or performing arts. Like I run into so many people that are right-brained and artistic, and I actually think that serves me really well personally, because I think my lack of a traditional business school education has actually been a bit of an advantage, because I solve problems very differently than, say, somebody with their MBA might. Or I walk into situations without preconceived notions about the quote-unquote right way to do things. And I also just think that I have a creative's brain in general. So I look at things in really big pictures. I'm not super linear and analytical. And that part of it has served me very well in marketing, and especially as an executive, when you have to get to the level of strategic, you know, 50,000 foot view of the situation. I think that's been really helpful.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because I'm theater arts and psychology, and I usually, I guess I joke, but it's really not a joke, because I kind of think that, you know, like you said, being in marketing communications, some sort of idea on the creative side of things balanced with, with the behavioral stuff from psych, I think if you weren't going to get one, I mean, in some ways, I think it's, like you said, it is better in some ways.
Yeah, and the psychology aspect is especially interesting, especially when you're applying it to consumer behavior or market behavior or motivational things that actually drive people to take action. I mean, all those things are, I think, relevant to what we do.
Well, being a right brainer, I sometimes say things that I think sound good without fully, you know, hashing out their meaning. It's admissions week here on the On Brand podcast. But one of those is that I do think that this, you know, whether call it marketing, communications, brand building, I think it's as much art as science, and I don't always think that we get people, or that there are enough people with both sides of with both perspectives. And it's tricky to build those.
It definitely is.
Yeah. So you talked a bit about, you know, the consumer behavior side of things. I mean, what do you think, you know, because it seems like the modern consumer is changing, to say the least.
Oh, gosh. I would say so. I think it's really a function, to me anyway, of how much information is available in the universe of things that drive decision making. It used to be that the marketers were sort of the harbingers of all the information because we worked for the companies, we put that stuff out into the world, and we kind of told consumers what they needed to know. But now with the tables have really turned, and content as a whole on the web, things like everything from reviews to consumer generated content to the ad hoc and unscripted conversations that happen across the web, you now have the power very clearly in the hands of the consumer when it comes to buying. So we used to always talk about the marketing funnel, right? And people being aware and then considering and then deciding and then buying. And now that thing is like a big old mess because you get points of information so many places along the way that I think now consumers, by the time they get to our doorstep, whether it's B2C or B2B, by the time they get to our doorstep, they're almost decided already about their purchase decision, or they're armed to the teeth with lots of great questions and smart information. So our job as marketers has shifted from really only caring about eyeballs at the top of the funnel to really addressing people's questions and concerns closer to the point of purchase and then creating a really excellent experience after the purchase. And I think that's different than it used to be.
It is different, and it's awesome, and it's also scary, I would imagine, too. Your not so ridiculously long bio talks a lot about working with executives as well. How do you? There's got to be a lot of fear around that. How do you navigate and advise marketing leadership today on this kind of flipped behavior on branding, consumer behavior?
Wow. That's a big question.
It is. Unpack that, chew on that,
in 30 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
I think what I find the difference between, working with executives and working with, what I would term a marketing practitioner is there's a bit of a generational gap for sure. So the people who are in executive roles now were practitioners, say, 10 years ago, maybe 15, before all this stuff happened. So they've got a leg in both worlds. And I find that getting them to sort of, A, believe that there really is that much power in the customer's hands is a bit of a challenge. And the first question out of their mouths is usually around the risks associated with this. So they want to make sure that they understand all the things that could go wrong before they're really willing to hear about what could go right. So I approach it a lot of times with sort of allaying fears early on and saying, look, there are still plenty of things you have in and under your control as a company, and there are plenty of ways to get out ahead of this kind of thing and manage the risks associated with it. And now let's talk about how this actually drives revenue. Which brings me to my second point, is that when you talk to executives, they care about the bottom line. That's their job. So you can't go into it with unicorns and rainbows and isn't this going to be fun and start talking about engagement and community before you start saying this is how it's going to help you drive better business decisions and ultimately save money in terms of costs or earn money in terms of revenue. If you can't speak at that level, you're not going to keep their attention.
You talked about driving business decisions and making better decisions. And I know that, you know, this might be some of what you're going to talk about next month at the Social Brand Forum as well. But I feel like there's a connection here among talking about how we use this intelligence that we gather to make decisions, but also, to build brands, to learn about the different market segments we can develop brands for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And communicate those offerings too. So how's that happen?
Well, what's really interesting is we have this kind of glut of data right now. We have so much information coming in that it's really difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff. But I think if you look at it in context of if you understand very clearly what you want your brand to be, it becomes a little bit easier to filter out the information that can actually help you make progress toward that goal. So one of my favorite definitions of brand was always, Zay Frank calls it the emotional aftertaste that you leave with people who interact with your company. So to me, the unfiltered sentiment and conversation and connections that people make online right now are living, breathing emotional aftertastes of people's experiences with your brand. So all you have to do is spend 5 minutes searching on Twitter for a brand like maybe a telco or a cable company that people traditionally despise and or have difficulties with, and then they go in and you read and you can just see that living, breathing emotional aftertaste. And conversely, for very beloved brands, you can see that alive and well in these kind of impulsive conversations that people have. So mining that data for the intelligence around, is the brand we are trying to deliberately create lining up with what we're seeing people define our brand as out there, is really a strong litmus test for whether you're making progress toward your goals. And I think that, you know, we used to have to undertake really expensive market research and really kind of formalized marketing programs to evaluate brand health and brand awareness. And I think there's still value in some of those traditional tools, but now we have this added layer of being able to pull information from the real-time web that actually gives us insight into, is our brand being reflected back to us in the way that we are trying to form it? And if not, what do we need to do to change that? So is it a customer service issue? Is it a brand perception issue? Is it a reputational thing? Is it something about our products and services not being up to par? But I think we get so much better information than we've ever had about how to adjust and tweak what we do and how we do it, that it's a pretty exciting time to be a marketer because, man, we have some really cool tools at our fingertips.
Oh yeah, I mean, I love that definition of branding of being the emotional or of brand being the emotional aftertaste because it's not just it's what you're leaving someone with, and the idea that we can really get greater insight into. I mean, because before you could say something like that, and you're like, "Oh, great! How could you possibly measure this aftertaste or diagnose any gaps that might exist in it?" But we mm-hmm. do have that power more than ever yeah. before.
Absolutely. And it's pretty exciting because I happen to work in that space and seeing the world of social data evolve from 8 or 9 years ago when I first entered this technology sector to how it's changed now that many years later. Is really eye-opening because it's not just the volume of data, but it's also the capabilities we have to put data science against that data and build really cool algorithms to pull out insights that we could never get from traditional survey-based data. We just couldn't. So now we can do really cool mashups of data or understand kind of unspoken tendencies in data, and all that stuff is just really, it's easy to geek out on. It's very cool.
So that kind of begs the question then, how do you, with all of the cool things that you can do, how do you know what makes the most sense for your brand, what you should be working, what insights you should be teasing out for
your
business?
Well, again, I think that all goes back to having a really sound plan of attack. It sounds so elementary, and I always feel a little bit like an idiot when I say this, but you have to have a clear goal for what you want your brand to be. So you need an ideal where somebody comes and says, oh, when I think of Nick Westergaard, I think of a super smart, funny, intellectual guy who draws really well and has a great podcast. If that's what you're after, then it's a lot easier to say, okay, this segment of data is not going to be as particularly relevant to me because it's not going to have a bearing on those four or five brand attributes that I want people to remember. So part of it is just having a really clear goal. The second piece of it is you need to have a benchmark. So you need to do a really good, sound, and honest analysis of how far along you think you are on that path. So what's your brand resonance look like today? How do people talk about you? If they're not talking about you, that's information in itself. When they say things about you or to you, what are they? Are they positive things? Are they not so positive things? Or are they kind of indifferent? All of those things are pieces of information. So you need to benchmark kind of where you sit today. And then it starts getting a lot easier to say, okay, we have gaps between, we want to be perceived as trustworthy, but people are saying outright that they don't trust us. So what can we do to close that gap? People are on the web are amazingly forthcoming with information about what works for them, what doesn't work for them. And they're incredibly responsive when you ask them for feedback or opinions. So I think the very first place to start is having that benchmark and trying to discern the gaps between where you are today and where you want to be tomorrow.
It's funny you talk about feeling a little elementary. I struggle with that too, because that's a big part of my message when I speak. And you kind of feel like, oh my God, am I doing like strategy 101 here? But it's amazing. Yep. It's partially kind of like the speaker gut check, like, you know, you chicken out at the last minute. Oh my God, what if I've leveled this information completely wrong? But it's amazing how much it hits. And I wonder, is everything happening so fast? Have we kind of clouded up some of that classic strategy that music and theater majors aren't supposed to know as much about as we do?
Yeah, I do think that I think we all suffer even in our day-to-day work lives. I mean, when was the last time that you actually sat down and strategically dealt with your personal or professional goals rather than just the thing that happens to be on top of your inbox that day? So I think, you know, companies are dealing with that at scale. So trying to balance the reactivity of needing to address whatever is coming in the door in that moment and deliberately carving out time, energy, and thought process toward the strategic process is really difficult. And I think when we get in rooms and worry about talking at the too basic a level to people, but then you start to see the heads nod and people going, yes, 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 yes. Part of it is that we're validating information that they already think they know, but need to commiserate on it, because you may have one really great strategist on your team who is surrounded by people who are reactionary, and they're looking for a little validation that, yes, you do need to slow down sometimes and take stock of these things and have a sound, basic, classic 101 strategy in place. So I think part of our jobs is to be the commiserator and go out and say, yep, it's true. There are lots of people that don't think this way, and which astounds me every time. Yeah. But there, I think a lot of those folks are just grateful to have somebody say that to them and validate what they're already thinking. There's a lot more smart marketers out there than I think we give them credit for.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you talk about executives, and you also mentioned kind of the difference between the executives and the marketers. the marketing practitioners in the trenches. And that's something else I kind of think of with the, you know, beyond the social data, social intelligence side of the Amber Naslin brand. I'm also reminded of, you know, all of the great stuff that that you and Jay have in the Now Revolution on working with teams. And, you know, it's such a big part of kind of the brand building engine that we all have is getting our people off the bench and into the game. But it seems like that's missed oftentimes as well. Why do you think that is?
You know, what's really interesting about the book that we wrote is I swear, Jay and I say this all the time. I swear it's more relevant today than
I
wrote it. We were a little bit ahead of the game, I guess. I don't know.
Because I also should interject that though neither of us spent time in the College of Business at the University of Iowa, we both have a presence there today. I teach there, but your book is also The Now Revolution is also on the syllabus there. And my initial question, because I was thinking about teams involving people, and my original approach to the question was going to be, based on, you know, how many years ago was it that you wrote that?
It was published in 2011.
Yeah. So I was going to say, what's changed? How are things different? And I spend a lot of time in that book, and I'm like, I can't ask that because it doesn't seem dated.
Yeah.
So much is, I guess, is the other side of that, you know, because, you know, you could say that with a lot of other books, and it's like, this is different now. This is different.
I think part of it is we stuck to kind of evergreen strategic level stuff and not tools and tactics, because those are the things that always change. And I think that strategically, maturity-wise, companies still have a ways to go in terms of formalizing a lot of this stuff as part of their day-to-day marketing practice. So when you talk about building teams, for instance, you go and talk to digital team members or even social team members in companies, and they're still super isolated and they're not really kind of embedded in the entire marketing organization. It's still seen as a job. And one of the things that Jay and I talk about in the Now Revolution is about social not being a job forever. We believe that it needs to become a skill that anybody can wield across an organization in a number of different ways. So if you think about the emergence of the web back in the 90s, we had web specialists and we had people who were like the boss of the internet stuff.
The webmaster.
Yeah, we had a webmaster, which always sounded so great to me.
But, it's awesome.
Like it sounds like a Dungeons and Dragons.
Exactly. I'm the webmaster.
Yeah, right. But then eventually the web part of things became ubiquitous. Everybody in the business uses the web in some way, shape, or form, and it becomes a tool that is then leveraged contextually however it needs to be. So whether you're in HR, you use the web for one thing. If you're in marketing, you use it for something else. And I think social's eventual maturity, I still believe, will go in that direction, that everyone from IT to HR to marketing will know and understand the tenets around digital presence, and they'll just use it in different ways. And we won't have the social media specialist anymore, because everybody in their own way will be a specialist and figure out how to apply it to their own job description. But we're nowhere near that yet. Because we're still in the nascent stages of adoption, I would say, of a lot of the social and digital tools and approaches. And I think we're still going to have kind of dedicated specialists for a while as people start to figure this out and realize that it's applicable to more than just marketing.
And is not the bigger opportunity, too, when you talk about social not being a job, becoming a skill that will exist across all of those departments, is not the bigger opportunity fostered by all these tools and technology that everyone in the organization, even beyond the marketing department, has the potential to be a brand advocate, a part of the brand building process?
Completely. I think that one of the things that these tools do inside of companies is democratize the idea of the spokesperson or the brand advocate or the employee advocate. So we're working on an employee advocacy program right now at Sysomos to sort of eat our own dog food in a way, and get smart about, like, not just isolating the people who are smart about how to build our brand. They don't just live in the marketing department. You know, we have brilliant social media specialists that are our support team. We have brilliant people on our sales teams who interact with customers every day and understand their needs and wants. And we have brilliant people on our product and engineering side that don't get a lot of customer facing time, but are really passionate about what they do and what they're building. So how do we harness that? And, put up a couple of very gentle guide rails, but then kind of empower people to be out there and talking and sharing what they know. I think that's incredibly powerful brand building. But it also scares the pants out of a lot of people because it's a little Wild Westy and, God help us if we can't control the message kind of thing. So it's still a culture shift. And I've long said that social's emergence is much more about culture change and the culture shift inside of companies than it is operational change, because the operational stuff is it can be tricky, but it's certainly more straightforward than the change management that comes alongside being so open and so transparent and so sort of atomized across the company with letting people do their thing online. It's a different world now, and we're kind of in the middle of that shift, and it's a little sticky sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the culture stuff too. I mean, huge operative, but big stuff, scary stuff. I mean, what's the miracle pill that you can take and have the culture thing fixed?
Oh God, I wish there were one. I really do. It there is no such thing. It's a long, consistent slog over time, and you'll take two steps forward and you'll take one step back. And again,
just I'll like look, Paula Abdul.
Yeah. Or was that her? God.
MC, her and MC Scat Cat.
I'm a little frightened that you know that.
Yeah. There's other stuff that, again, it's the right brain stuff. There's important formulas that I don't have, but I have that.
Well, I'm impressed. I'm an 80s music junkie myself, and I didn't even know that one. So I'm like, wow, that's
crazy. Opposites attract.
Okay, that one I do know. That's good. Oh God. All right, I gotta have.
I totally derailed this great, this great culture point that you were making. You were on a roll with a cadence, and I went off on bad 80s lyrics.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll bring it back around.
Okay.
With Culture Club. No, I'm kidding.
There you go.
But
done.
The culture thing is tricky because, again, we have an interesting generational gap, and it's not just about age, it's about value sets. So people who are now in executive roles grew up in business in a very different time than the upstarts that are coming into companies now. They have just a different kind of point of view on the world. So culturally, I think one of our biggest challenges today is that gap. Is the values gap we have within leadership, between leadership and practitioner levels in organizations. I think as the current executive generation retires out of companies or goes off and does, forever consulting or whatever it is you do these days when you retire.
Forever consulting. I like that.
Yeah. if you go out and do that, I think you're going to see a different generation of leaders come in that have this kind of culture just baked into their DNA. The digital natives, as you call them, out there, these people are going to lead differently, and they've got different perspectives on how things should be done. A lot of our talent at Sysomos in the leadership ranks comes from very traditional corporate backgrounds. We have folks who were leaders at Microsoft, leaders at Dun & Bradstreet. And they all, of course, are like, they're still tech and they still do cool stuff, but they're also still of an age where PR is handled by the PR person. And the idea that one of your employees would be a spokesperson is like, nuh-uh, no way. So, you know, even in our own organization, we work and live in this social space. We still have a culture shift to make to, you know, take those digital values and pervade them across our own company. So I don't think it's unique to anybody. And I certainly don't think it's going to be, it's not a switch you flip. It's lots of little steps over time. That you take a small risk and it pays off, and then you have permission to take a little bit bigger one next time. It's a distance game, not a sprint.
You know, you talked a couple times, kind of bookending our entire conversation here with the generational shifts, you know, both in terms of talking about, we started talking about exec leadership, now we're back at the team level. And it's interesting, listening to you say that, because I'd never thought about it that way. But you know, I think you and I are close in age, and you know, you hear so much about digital natives, millennials, and sometimes I roll my eyes. It's like, why are we like, you know, taking apart how different they are? Mm-hmm. But it's relevant when you have this generational mashup of millennials who are not a part of my generation per se. But then the generation a little ahead of ours that is in the exec leadership role, and kind of looking at, well, how do you make sense of all of this? And I think from those that are consulting and working with all of these different levels to mm-hmm. those that maybe are members of these different groups and thinking how you manage up, down, and all around.
Yeah, I have an interesting perspective because I am I'm certainly the youngest member of our executive leadership team, and not by a little, like by several years. And then, and I think our executive leadership team is actually relatively young. I think, you know, nobody's over maybe their early 50s. So even still, you and I are part of, you know, the Gen Xers that we're pretty much the last generation that has both a foot in today's digital environment and still remembers a world without it. Because we came into our professional careers right about the time that the web was taking off. So you know, I just turned 40, and it's really amazing to me to think back to how I worked in the first jobs I had. When the web was still this kind of newfangled, scary thing, and nobody was quite sure how to wrangle it, to now it's such an integral part of the work that I do. I couldn't even imagine what my job would look like without it. So there's distinctly, I think it matters to understand how people came up through the business world and how digital has influenced or not influenced their careers in order to really have a strong handle on culture shift. Because you have to understand where somebody is coming from before you can get them to go anywhere different. And, you know, I think millennials get a bad rap in so many ways, but I think they are the harbingers of change in these companies, because as they mature and come into professional roles and, you know, take some of the hard knocks of the business world, that'll probably knock their idealism down a notch or two, but they'll also come in with new, fresh, different ideas that I think can fundamentally change the way we operate our companies. But it's going to take, you know, it's going to take a while for us to accept that as a business culture, and for those young people to rise in companies enough at the ranks where they have decision-making power to make some of those changes.
Yeah. Well, as we start to wrap up here, I have to ask you one of our favorite questions, thinking of all of these different things beyond Paula Abdul and MC Scat Cat. Is there a brand that you can think of that has made you smile recently?
Just this morning, as a matter of fact, there's a great company called BarkBox. I'm a total animal nerd, obviously. And BarkBox is like a subscription box that you get every week or every month for your dogs. And it's got treats and toys and all kinds of stuff. And we love it. And the dogs know when the BarkBox is here. They can smell it the minute it comes in the door. But they do a lot of work for rescue advocacy and all this kind of stuff. So I pay a lot of attention to what they're doing. And this morning, of course, on the anniversary of 9/11, they are doing, they have a video up that is a tribute to the oldest known living search and rescue dog that was on the grounds on 9/11. And wow. They sort of did this whole best day ever thing where they gave the dog like this really cool day in New York City, and she got to go to hotels and get treats and ride in cabs and do meet and greets with people. And it was a really, I loved how positive it was. I loved how on brand the whole thing was. And it was a really sweet tribute to this pup. She's like a 16-year-old golden retriever, I think. But BarkBox in general is a brand I love. They have tons of personality. I always get a kick out of what they're doing, but it's always on brand, always, always, always on brand. And they have a really distinctive kind of voice and personality, and it just, they're fun to watch.
Well, I mean, that 9/11 example is great, because I think sometimes when there are, you talk about all the real-time intelligence and information, and I think sometimes there's a thought that we have to make our brands a part of it. And I think most of the time that's really not the best move. But something like this, if you have if you're a relevant part of the story,
right?
Then it's a night and day difference.
And to be fair, I BarkBox, I don't believe, was the one that created the video, but that was how they chose to engage in that discussion today. And I just thought it was perfectly on point for them. And it really aligned with their brand values, but they didn't stray too far into that trying way too hard to be relevant in a potentially very touchy kind of environment online today. You know there's going to be that brand that goes out there and says, like, everything's going to be $9.11 today. So you know that they're going to be out there. And I thought this was a really tasteful way to participate and share a really great story, but still keep it tasteful and relevant.
Awesome. Well, Amber, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
Okay, well, I have my own blog that has been sorely neglected, but I'm trying to get back in the swing of things over there.
Two whole posts this week.
I know. It's crazy. I'm on a tear. but you can find me over there at brasstackthinking.com. I've been blogging there for years and years and years, so you can even dig through the archives and still find some pretty decent stuff, if I do say so myself. And then professionally, you can find my company at Sysomos, S-Y-S-O-M-O-S.com. And we're a social intelligence platform. So you don't see me all over that website, but I'm proud of the company I work for, and I love the stuff that we do.
Great. Well, Amber, thank you so much for being on brand with us, and we look forward to seeing you next month here in Iowa.
Can't wait. Thanks so much.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our listeners. Recently, Mary Tamaki Green enjoyed our episode on, very topical considering what we just talked about, employee engagement and building brands with Siegel & Gale's Tom Wyatt. Thanks, Mary, for listening. And a reminder, if you heard something that you liked on this episode or another, or if you have a question you'd like one of our guests to answer, let me know on Twitter using the hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Last but not least, you can find links to everything that we talked about over at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating or review, help others find the show. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by the industry-leading Social Brand Forum. Save $100, see Amber, learn more about Sysomos by using the promo code ONBRAND when you register now at socialbrandforum.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.